Hello, everyone, and I guess I should be saying Happy New Year, Happy 2026. As you did not hear from Scott and I in the month of January, our apologies. Sometimes life just gets in the way, but we are back. It is a frigid February. I hope you are all having a good start to 2026 as the people in Oklahoma and New Mexico go, what, cold? Yeah. In Columbus, Ohio, we were excited because it hit 30 degrees. The snow from a week and a half ago is finally starting to melt. So... welcome, everyone, to the first ACO Pedescast podcast for 2026. We have an excellent guest and an excellent topic that I think you all like. But before we get to that, I want to say Happy New Year and welcome to Scott Cyrus. Scott, how are you doing?
We are doing good here in Oklahoma. We were spent most of the time in New Mexico, and it was wonderful weather there. Now it was up to about 75 degrees yesterday in Oklahoma, but it was great. But, you know, when you said we didn't do a podcast in January, I thought I heard some people clapping in the background there, but I wasn't sure. But anyway, I just hope I didn't. But you never know. But anyway, no, we're really happy to be back, and hope everybody is trying to thaw out. And darn it, you know, the groundhog saw his shadow. So we got six more weeks of this misery. So hopefully we can get to into spring and everybody will be able to get out and start enjoying the outdoors.
Yep. You know, we do have, just so everyone is aware, we do have one little caveat, even though we did miss. One podcast that is always popular this time of year for our students is the Managing VSLOW and Audition Rotations. So just so you know, we will be re-releasing episode 43, which is our podcast on that topic with our former fourth year med student trustee, Madison Kraft. We will be re-releasing that one in conjunction with this. So if you do, for those of you who are students and you do want to get a little briefer on that, make sure to listen to that. But we have a very, very good topic today. But before I introduce our guest, Scott, I just want to ask, how do you deal with the post-holiday winter drearies?
Well, you know, it always kind of depends on, you know, when you think about my post-holiday drearies, we're really a very big upbeat because I retired from practice as of January 1. I celebrated decreasing my workload from 2 full-time jobs down to 1 full-time job. Not fully retired, just fully retired from practice. We celebrated that come January 1st. But I know that a lot of people have, you know, difficulties with the winter blues and such. And I always have always believed in celebrating the little successes. If I had a tough day at work and I got through it and it seemed like it was great, even though I was tired and I feel like I gave my 100% all the way through the day, then that was my little success in the world. So I always look forward to that. And, you know, with the transition of ownership we did, it was really, really good. But, you know, it's just different. It's funny. I looked at my phone 1,000 times in the month of January thinking I missed a phone call because my phone always seemed like it was ringing. But it was good. And I'm just focusing on the teaching aspects of things. It's been really good.
Well, congratulations for that. And I'm glad you were able to celebrate. But, you know, there are definitely a lot of people who holiday time, post-holiday time, or year-round, you know, struggle. And I think one of the things that we haven't touched on a lot here is the mental health aspect. I think that is something that is, when we think of taking care of our entire patient and ourselves, we have to be thinking about taking care of our mental health. And I am very happy with that to introduce our guest for today. So we have Dr. Olivia Shadid, who is an assistant professor at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, is the associate program director for the Child Psych Fellowship. But more importantly, she takes her work out into the community, working as a consultant for primary care providers, working with a lot of projects, working with Medicaid and foster children, which we cannot thank you enough for doing the work that you do in that space. But I want to welcome Dr. Shadid to the Pedescast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason, and for that very nice introduction. It's just a pleasure to be here with you both today.
Well, we are very fortunate to have you. And for those of you who are listening, it was a small reunion as the Dr. Shadid spent some time in a certain someone's office who he doesn't have anymore.
Yeah, I had the fortunate, I was fortunate to have her shadow me and you know, hopefully had a little influence. Her father is a child psychiatrist also and a good friend of mine. Somebody I consulted multiple times when I felt like I was over my head, and he was always welcoming and said, you know, one of those guys that always made you smile, said, you're doing a great job and try this, try that, and was always a good friend and a good consultant. Hopefully that pointed her in the right direction, that we all know there's not enough child psychiatrists in our world to take care of all the problems that are out there. So it does many times fall on the shoulders of general pediatricians to at least address some of their issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very fun to be here with Dr. Cyrus, where I shadowed as a pre-med. So for all of you pre-meds and students out there listening, you might be on a podcast one day with that attending that you so look up to and think, how do they know all this and manage all of this? So it makes me feel a little old when the practice was sold and that you're retired from it. I'm like, oh no, that was a few years ago now. But absolutely. Yeah, you know, primary care doctors are really the first line for everything, bless you, including mental health.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I'm fortunate here in Columbus, we do have a large dedicated behavioral health pavilion that is an inpatient behavioral health. But even with that, as Scott said, it is so hard, and it's such a treasured resource to have our child psychiatrist and our behavioral health specialist that we can send some of our children to. I just wanted to start by one asking you, you know, this is it's a difficult field. Now, I know you have a little bit of a experience with your father, but what led you to go into not just psychiatry, but the very complex field and difficult field of pediatric psychiatry?
Yeah, I think, and, you know, preaching to the choir that like working with kids and supporting their health is just such a meaningful job, as all pediatricians and ped subspecialists know that. I think especially when you spend time in med school seeing adults and you think like if someone could have gotten to them 30 years ago, where would they be and where would their children be and where would their community be? So I think that early intervention piece is so, so big. We know it's, you know, if a kiddo has one person in their life who validates them, who sees their good, who names that for them, it changes their whole life trajectory. And getting to potentially do that as someone who works with kids is really compelling and really meaningful. And I graduated fellowship a year and a half ago, and you know, not too long ago, but still feel every day it's so worthwhile. And kids are so fun, and you get to stay hip to the culture and learn. Like yesterday, you know, I was asking a teen how she was doing, and she was like 6'7". Mom, not 6'7", me. So I think it's very fun too.
So then you're a great person to ask, what does 6'7" mean?
As a 6'7". There's a hand motion that goes along with it. I will leave that for interpretation by the youth.
I did hear that apparently one of the dancing grass stalks in Bad Bunny's halftime show did break out into the 6'7" dance. I wouldn't have known. But it's like, I saw that on the social media today.
Yes.
Yeah. The Instagram. So why don't you talk a little bit about how you interact with primary care providers as a mental health specialist, that kind of sense that maybe they need something a little bit more?
That's a great question. And the collaboration is so important. And it really goes both ways. I was thinking about that, Scott, when you were mentioning working with my dad as a child psychiatrist. I'm sure he reached out to you as well and is like, this kid's heart rate, what, how worried should I be about this? This lab value. You know, we psychiatrists can hang up our stethoscopes a little bit compared to some other specialties. And so it's so nice to have two-way consults and discussions. I think, you know, if you're like a kiddo's primary care doctor and you were seeing them for wellness checks, you know, since they were itty-bitty throughout their life, it's a really important role and a really important insight. If a kid starts to struggle, it's not like you're seeing them for the first time and you're like, oh yeah, so-and-so is always this way. You're noticing changes, right? You're noticing changes in the family dynamic, maybe you're seeing siblings. And so I think recognizing that you have a really valuable insight into like who this child is in a really holistic way, and you're also experts in development, right? So you're kind of assessing like, oh, that's a normal teenage thing, or like, whoa, that's really kind of beyond what we would expect like maybe all 13-year-olds are a little sassy or more isolated, but you're noticing changes and how it's affecting a kiddo's sort of quality of life in their relationship. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind is like sort of trusting your instincts as a primary care doctor, super huge. And the family is also going to have a lot of buy-in with that, that they really trust you. If you tell them you're worried about something, it matters a lot more than, you know, some random referral or someone in an ED telling them some concern. So just recognizing like that place of power and influence in a kiddo's life.
You know, that kind of pinpoint type of consultation is so important. I know from a practitioner standpoint, you know, a lot of times you can get kind of this broadcast or this, what I call a scattergun consult. And it doesn't really, that key really doesn't fit the lock, you know, and cause each child, as we all know, is totally different. And what's really stressing them or what's really, if you will, setting them off in a direction that we all recognize is not good, is many times very unique to that one child. It could be the death of a grandparent or, you know, loss of a girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. Now, you know, when you think about unique things to children, I've been really over the last probably 10 to 15 years amazed at how much anxiety, depression have just really crept into our kids. Are you seeing this in your practice?
Yeah. And you know, it's something the Surgeon General a couple of years ago mentioned, like there is an epidemic of youth mental health struggles. And I think sort of as a field and as a broader society, we don't exactly, you know, we can't point to one thing and say like, gosh, this one thing changed and now all these kiddos are struggling. So there's definitely sort of multidimensional, it's complex. I think a couple kind of the ideas that most stick out to me and make sense and gel with what I'm seeing clinically is, you know, I think a lot about teens and preteens in particular who are struggling in these ways. And having that loss of community and in-person interaction and developmentally appropriate ways to engage in meaningful activities, to kind of see themselves as like part of a larger community. Because I think, and a part of it, right, is screens, and that we sort of get like sort of cheap hits from being on a screen that feel like we're connected. Kids use the term parasocial relationships sometimes, and they get at like, oh yeah, I know everything that's going on with my best friend. But if you actually haven't been in person with them and have those vulnerable moments of interacting and communicating and messing up, and they still like you and they're still there, kids aren't getting to practice those skills that are really important human skills. And they don't get to be vulnerable and learn that that's okay, right? My guess is that's a part of it, is not having kind of those broader community and in-person interactions. And I think a lot of it, you know, when thinking about unique aspects of working with kids, so much of it is working with their caregivers and parents too, right? And I think a lot of parents and caregivers feel, you know, that they want their kids to be safe, and maybe they're safer if they're sitting at home on a screen. We have to also ask there's always a risk benefit, right? And what's lost by them not getting more in-person interactions, even if they're awkward, and maybe that's a part of the point. Those are some of the things I think about. I don't know for you all kind of what come up or what you're hearing patients say or research that you're familiar with kind of on that topic.
My patients don't talk.
I mean, neonatal.
But I do talk with the parents a lot. And, you know, I think one of the books that I'm sure, I don't know if Scott's read of it, I guess, but, you know, like I read The Anxious Generation. And I think about when I was growing up, like you had a way to disconnect from certain stimuli. You know, there weren't cell phones. There weren't, you know, if you wanted to call your best friend or whatever, you picked up the landline and you dialed and you maybe got a busy signal. And, you know, when I turned 13, I think is when the internet started, and like you had to run your phone line to your computer and get your, and so there was that ability to disconnect, and also to that ability to go out and experience things tactily. I think, and one of the things that I think that book talks about as well is that there's really not an off switch anymore. There's not like, you know, you can't tell your child not to be on the computer when now so much of like their homework is online and so much of this is online. So they're going to be on there. And you turn off your phone, like I turn off my phone and my watch still dings, right? So
you know, BRB, you're never away from
it. Exactly. Like there's no AOL away message anymore, right? So because it's just always there. And I do think, you know, that there is that this upcoming generation is a generation that is that has just lived in a state of constant overstimulation. And I don't know if you have ideas or how, like, as pediatricians, that we can talk to them about, like, tips on how to get back from that. Do you have tips on how to break that cycle? And when they realize that they're overstimulated, but they don't know how to not.
That's a great question. It's, again, I'm thinking about, you know, conversations I had in my clinic yesterday because it's such a big discussion. And I love that you said, Jason, about like how to get back from it. Because I think we can think about prevention. And if you're working with a certain type of family or a certain age, you may be able to provide some like education before the kiddo gets that social media or gets the phone in their hand. But for a lot of kids, like cat's out of that. So how do we think about it in that scenario? And I think so I always try to think about if it's an older kid and as much as we possibly can, how do we get the kid to have some buy-in to kind of these discussions? Like, it's not going to go well if mom is like, your whole life is on the phone and you're getting bullied on there constantly. And of course, you don't want to miss any notification because what are people saying about you? I'm taking it away. Like, they'll just explode and get referred to me and we'll need to kind of support them from there. But if you can get the kid on board, right, and they say, yeah, you know, my schoolwork is suffering, or like I really miss cheer and I quit it because I was kind of too distracted with other stuff, or my sleep was so poor because of my grades and I'm not doing as well in football or whatever it is. And you can help them sort of, and this is classic like motivational interviewing stuff, but help them develop some insight into like, what are the awesome parts about having social media or your phone? Cool. That's really good to know. We validate that you like it. And like you said, Jason, for adult brains, this is powerful technology and it's hard to fight. So not telling them like they're bad or aberrant for wanting to be on their phone all the time. It makes sense that they do. And is it causing any problems? And then if they can have some insight, then they often can work better with their caregivers on like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have it all night, or maybe I shouldn't have it during class, or whatever it might be for that individual child. Like Scott said, some kids, and it's kind of like with any addictive substance, right? Some kids can have full access to a phone all the time from a young age, and they do great. And probably because they're connected in meaningful things throughout their life, they're getting those supports and needs for connection in other healthy ways. But then another kid just destroys them. You know, they cannot focus. They're overwhelmed. They're overstimulated. So I would, that's one kind of tip that I find helpful and is very patient-centered, which always feels nicer than just telling them what to do. And you get to model for the parents, like, hey, this is how you give age-appropriate autonomy and decision-making for the kiddo. I don't know if you all have found other things helpful when talking with parents about this and kids.
You know, I always say sometimes just take a weekend and unplug. But of course, I don't know which is worse, the anxiety the phone causes or the anxiety that not the phone causes, you know. But I do know that many times in my practice that there would be times where kids would be up all night long. And then, of course, they'd be extremely, extremely tired during the day. They'd be falling asleep during school and not doing well in school. And they, you know, we kind of just said, okay, why don't we do this? Why don't we give mom your phone at night and that you can sleep? And it would work some, and others, it create more anxiety than it calmed down because they were afraid they were going to miss something. And then, of course, you've also got this child who's almost a social isolate, the loneliness that kicks in. How do you approach those children to, you know, get them kind of back on track where they believe that what they're doing is helping them?
Yeah, I think about like, okay, if they're not, that totally makes sense, again, for teens in particular who really need those relationships. Like, if we can't just take one coping skill away without some other coping skill available. So we have to have kind of other ways for them to plug in. So figuring out, like, what are activities or youth groups or whatever it is that they care about, they're excited about, it's meaningful to their identity, and plugging them in. There was an interesting study in the last year or so that surveyed teens, and teens said that if given the choice, they would hang out in person. But I think so often that's not available for multiple reasons. So then they get the connection through their phone instead. One tip I like, there's some nice research that sometimes parents are like, I can't, they feel really disempowered that they can't set limits with the kid. And they feel like I can't take their phone away. They just, really get overwhelmed, they get dysregulated, I don't want to deal with it. So how do we show them there's other ways of being? So the cool research is that parents change their phone use, kids do too. So there kind of has to be this modeling. So they're like, I don't even know, what do we do when we come home from work and school except all sit on our phones together? But if they see, oh, dad's doing something really cool, like I love that mom's into that, then there can be behavior changes. So that's nice. When parents are like, I can't get them to change, you tell, kind of give it back to the caregiver and say, if you can change some things, you might see benefit elsewhere. That's one little trick I like.
Not necessarily a wild segue, but one of the things right now, of course, you know, we're all stuck inside, right? So one of the things that get outside, enjoy it. It's like, well, you can't right now because it's -2. But bringing it into this timeliness of seasonal affective disorder, of like you're getting stuck inside, it's dark all the time, and you sit here and you try to, do you see certain trends? Do you see certain things that start to peak a little bit more in your clinic during this time of year? And are there warning signs or red flags that our pediatricians can look at as we're getting into this time where if their outlet was getting outside and riding a bike or going to shoot hoops at the court, or, you know, those sorts of things. And now that option is gone because you just can't do it. And so they don't have this. And so now there's this added component. Do you see any sort of extra trends that happen during these kind of dark winter months and things that, you know, our pediatricians should be looking out for, or things that they could kind of recommend or preemptively talk to them about?
I think it's great to let people know that, you know, we know there is major depressive disorder with the seasonal component. And interestingly, it could be any season, but most likely in the Northern Hemisphere, it's worse in winter, right? And again, there's probably multiple reasons for that. But letting, if you know a kid is susceptible, if you know there's a family history of a seasonal affective disorder, letting them know, like, hey, you might need a little extra support during the winter months. And maybe that is like, maybe this level of exercise or medication is good for you now. Maybe during those months, we have to increase that a little bit. There's certainly, you know, really interesting treatments as far as like bright light therapy, and that has some good data for seasonal affective disorder too. But I think probably letting people know, like, it can be hard when it's cold and dark and you're inside away from your coping skills. Holidays can be really hard for some people. There can be a lot of grief. There could be trauma reminders. There can be a lot of buildups and expectations, especially for kids, about what the holidays can be or should be. And then a lot of like disappointment or angst when it doesn't go as they intend. There can be heightened family interactions, and like everybody's schedule's out the window too. So we get dysregulated. We're staying up late. We're eating stuff differently. We're not doing the same kind of activities that keep us afloat the rest of the year. I think something too that's tricky. So I have a lot of patients, you know, we get to summer break and they're like, I don't need any meds. Like, what was that about? Like, I feel fine. And then I'm like, let's not change anything until school starts. So with kids, it's a little tricky because sometimes it can look like a seasonal component, but it's more related to academic stress or social stress in the academic setting. So I think just letting people know, like sometimes this time of year is really not fun for people. Sometimes it's great. Some people thrive. But just like normalizing that for kiddos and families and saying, you know, we might need to get a little more creative. And what are healthy, engaging ways of getting outside or being physically, maybe not in 13 degrees, but maybe being physically active. Like, is there any, you know, accessible ways to for our patients, right? Like, is there a free rec center, or what does the school have going on, or what are winter sports inside? Libraries are a really great resource, not so much for the physical activity component, but for free child-focused activities. Like, my local library has a Lego club, so kids can get together, meet other kids, do something cool. It's all free, which is, you know, they have to get a library card, but that's it. Those are some of the things that come to mind for me. I don't know if you all have favorite sort of insight. And I recognize I'm spoiled here in New Mexico where it's sunny and you can go outside all year, but we still see it. So see, yeah. Seasonal depression and low vitamin D. So you're not spared if you're in the...
I did my residency in Miami, Florida. So, but then my fellowship in Rochester, New York, where seasonal affective disorder is a real thing, it's very different. You brought up something, you talked about holidays and re-traumatizing and things like that. One thing that I do not know, don't think that a lot of our medical students or even our trainees get good training in, is trauma-informed care and the pillars of trauma-informed care. And obviously, we don't have hours for you to sit here and talk to us about how to do that approach. But are there any tips that you could give to the medical student or the trainee who are talking to that adolescent or going in and they can sense that, like, maybe there's, you know, distrust or there's something that is going on using those principles, those pillars of trauma-informed care?
Yeah, I love this question. I think, so one, kind of like we've been talking about the importance of, like, patient-centered care, that's where we're, like, restoring that autonomy and that choice which victims of trauma inherently, like, had taken away from them when trauma happened to them, especially, like, when we think about kiddos with, like, abuse or neglect by a caregiver. So letting them know, like, they're getting to choose. It's not about coercing them into things. Letting them know the limits of confidentiality and, like, what your role is really important, because, again, trauma mixes up roles. So letting them know, like, hey, I'm your doctor. Here's what that means. And then it's cool. It sets them up to feel empowered through, like, the rest of their time in healthcare into, like, you know, adulthood. And then the kind of last thing, and again, I love this for modeling for caregivers, but it's just making sure that pediatricians or co are regulating themselves. And it is hard. You all see so many patients and the pace is so fast and anything can, like, walk through the door at any time. But finding ways to sustain your own mental health and your own sense of calm is going to let you interact in a trauma-informed way rather than being caught up in your own dysregulation. Easier said than done, but something for us to keep in mind.
100%. I'm going to yield the floor to Dr. Cyrus because I've been asking a lot of questions here.
No, this is great. You know, I think that one of the things that I've noticed recently, probably in the last maybe 4 to 5 years, is the adolescent and even younger adolescent getting caught up in the political and global events that we see. And I mean, just recently here in Tulsa, we've had children get up and do a walkout at the high school over things that are going on in Minneapolis or things that are going on in other parts of the world. How do you see that adding to their anxiety or their stress or what that does to their academics? But how do you see that affecting the child?
That's a great question. I think, you know, sort of like you said, Scott, like, every kid is different. And for some kids, that could be really enlivening and really meaningful. And it helps them. Like you said, there's so much they can't control that they say, well, I can do this. And we know that's actually really helpful when there's angst about sort of big issues that affect us on, like, a global scale or a larger political scale. But if we do something about it, that makes us feel better. Doom scrolling tends to not be so healthy. So helping them, again, I think develops an insight into, like, what are the good things about it? What are the bad things about it? How do you want to maybe change? Like, how do you do more of the things that help you feel better and, like, you're a more active agent, and maybe do less of the things that just make you mad and sad and upset and kind of now you're staying home from school all day because you're so worried about what the state of the world and what's going to happen. You know, sort of letting them know, like, you can make a positive difference and we have to help you, say, get through high school in order to get to a place where you can amplify your impact. Curious, yeah, if you all have seen sort of other things or other kind of thoughts or tips on that.
It's interesting. And I think we as pediatricians have an interesting balance because one thing about the total connectedness is our patients are more, I don't want to say, because sometimes it's misinformed, but they're more informed than ever before. Because you're getting so much. But at the same time, we're dealing with a population where they don't really have a voice because they're not of voting age. How do we help this population tell that apart, but also deal with that dichotomy of they have this information and they have this passion, but what can they do with it? Because it's up to, you know, it's up to the quote unquote adults in the room to make those decisions. I don't know if you've heard this coming across in your clinics or things like that, or like how you help to tell them how to regulate that kind of paradox.
No, I think like, just like you said, Jason, like naming that and validating, like, it's hard. And all of us throughout the rest of life are going to struggle with only having so much power over things that we really care about. And I think it's really relevant for all generations right now, particularly with the advent of AI, right, is like figuring out, like, well, what is the source of things and where did that come from? And is that a real video or not? And that's a a tricky thing, but giving them some like media literacy tools, right? Like, you know, kind of basic stuff like, well, when was that posted and who posted it and what does that person have to gain? That's something that teens don't like being duped and feeling like they're being tricked or people are manipulating them. So if you kind of let them know, like maybe people are posting this to get you angry or to get you sad and not acting on things. And they're often really curious and they want to kind of understand how the world works. So that's one kind of approach you could go with. But I think just naming, like, things are hard and that's, you still have a heart and you still care. And that's really impressive. And we want to make sure we take care of that care and help it go in a healthy way, not one that's going to destroy you and kind of that fire that you have.
You know, it's interesting you say that because going on in, I believe it's Albuquerque, is the lawsuit against Meta. It's in New Mexico, I know for sure. And it's talking about how they have not done the job they needed to do to keep our kids safe and get them, you know, get them addicted to certain social media platforms. And you bring up a very good point where some people are, you know, set out to anger you. The other thing that I many times would use with my kids when they're talking about these social issues was, what can you do about it? What can you do about world hunger? And they, you know, of course, many times you go, well, I could do anything about world hunger. And I said, well, what about working at on a local level for hunger? What about a food bank? What about contributing to a food bank? What about, you know, volunteering your time at these places to see firsthand, what can you do instead of maybe just sitting at home and giving your time, giving your talents, because you have many of both of those. And it would say, well, maybe I can do something about it. You know, that would give them some ability to empower them to at least start locally and it maybe expand from there.
I think that's great. And I think I love like giving those practical kind of tips to caregivers and parents. And I think they get on board too, that if they have similar values, which they probably do if the kid does, that they want their kid to make a positive difference. And so it's, you know, maybe easier to convince mom to like drive you to the food bank on Saturdays than maybe like other locations. And then I think it plays into kind of what we were talking about. It lets them feel a part of the community and a part of something larger than themselves, which kids are so hungry to feel.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about conversations that we can have with our families and with our caregivers and with the kids as well. One of the things that I hear a lot when I'm working with residents is they talk about, like, we want to talk about all this with our kids. We want to do this, but we get 15 minutes, we get 20 minutes, and then someone is knocking on the door, you know, and we're going to get dinged if we're running late because that makes my attending run late. And so what tips or tricks do you have, especially for, you know, medical students or trainees, when there is something that maybe tingles their spidey senses that there's something more, but they just want to make sure that they're asking the right questions and they're asking them in a way that they can still be efficient, they can still do this, but make sure that we are taking care of the entire patient, which includes their mental health.
It's hard, and it's a, you know, sort of bigger issue. 15 minutes is so quick. I think, you know, people have mastered it. Scott might be one of those, the busy like peds clinic, but it's really difficult. So I think, again, one, just to name it, like if you maybe feel like you weren't able to go as in depth as you wanted, maybe that means you're a good doctor and you knew that there was a lot more to explore and you recognize the limitations of the clinical setting that you're in. And that's where that, like, maybe trauma-informed care, how do you help yourself regulate? And like, move on from maybe you're hearing about really terrible trauma and then you have to jump into this whole other, you know, well baby visit. That's a big kind of change of mind, but keeping mindfulness and regulated helps. I think when it comes to like mental health issues, it's really safety first, right? So, you know, asking about suicidality, a lot of people are like, I don't want to give them ideas, but there's a lot of research that tells us that asking explicitly, you know, if you're suspecting it, if you're noticing, again, you're like, their PC key, you're noticing some changes, asking like, hey, sometimes when people are really stressed, they start to have thoughts of, I don't want to be here anymore. I wish I was dead. I should kill myself. That's like verbatim the language that I use. And I do it basically every clinic visit because of the field I'm in. So one, kind of normalizing in the sense of they're not the only human who has ever struggled with this is helpful, and letting them know, like, we're going to talk about it because there's things we can do about it. So I think, like, if you're worried, ask because it doesn't give them ideas. It gives them space to connect with someone and get the help they need. And when it comes to depression, folks may be familiar with the PHQ-9, which is a depression screener, which is good and helpful. You know, if you have the capacity to like have your front desk collect that, that's cool. And people should know there's a PHQ-2. And actually, there's research that the most specific and sensitive question you can ask someone to find out if they're depressed is, are you depressed? So you can ask the kids you're working with, like, do you think you're depressed? Like, you're not enjoying stuff anymore? Are you feeling sad all the time? You can just ask it and name it. And it won't be perfect, but they might be like, yeah. And, oh, shoot. I need to redirect this clinic visit to focus on maybe safety is the next question. Or if they say no, you know, maybe they don't want to talk about it, possible, but there's a pretty good chance they're not. So that's one very quick 15-minute visit link kind of question screener you can use.
You know, to ask somebody that is, you know, used to be taboo, right. But I love that. That's the direct approach because, you know, parents will come in and say, I think he's depressed. And I'll look over and go, I used to tell you, do you think you're depressed? And it was like, you know, if they kind of hesitated and had to think about it, it was like, well, maybe you are depressed. I mean, you know, why don't we take a minute and add things up, you know? But I agree with Jason when somebody said, oh, by the way, oh, Lord. And that, in my book, it was always worse than the original problem they came in for. It was like, oh, I seems like I'm going to the bathroom a lot and I'm drinking a lot. And it's like, Jiminy Christmas, you got diabetes. And then you came in for a sniffly cold or something, you know? It's like, there goes my RBU for the 15-minute visit, you know? And it's just like, thank goodness my office manager, she didn't have me on an RBU, you know, basis, because I think I would have flunked that test.
Other tips on manage, like with the trainees you work with on like that 15-minute visit? I don't think I myself have mastered.
No, I mean, life is, especially with kids. I mean, you know, here we are, you know, like Jason said, his kids don't even have a voice. And well, they may have a voice. They may be screaming most of their time around Jason, especially, but he is their voice. I mean, he is their voice at a higher level. And the same thing. So we advocate for our kids. And sometimes when we do that, it just takes longer than 15 minutes. And we've all learned that. And mm-hmm. The parent will say, well, I don't want to do that because it's going to make them mad. I said, you need to do it because they're worth it. They're worth mm-hmm. making mad. Because sometimes they have to realize you have to stand in their way to say, you're going down a pathway I think is not healthy. And with that, you are doing them a big service, not a disservice. And so I think it's important, but you're exactly right. I used to ask them, what do you think? Are you depressed?
Yeah.
You know, you've hit on it a couple of times, but I think it is important. Also, you've talked about us as caregivers, making sure that we also self-regulate. And, you know, everything that is going on in the world, everything, you know, the winter glooms, the post-holiday glooms. I mean, I'll be honest, I had probably one of the worst holidays I've ever had in my adult life this past holiday. So, you know, I've been doing some of my own work at this, you know, but what tips do you have for us as caregivers and for our listeners as trainees who may be experiencing some hardships for the first time to mentally check in with themselves and how to process and make sure that we're also, you know, taking care of our own mental health during these times?
I think, again, one is recognizing like the job is hard. And if you're like, this is fine and there's no problems, maybe you're not doing it right or not paying attention to kind of the full scope of what's happening. Like seeing children suffer should be difficult, even as we kind of inhabit a role of like, I'm going to help, kind of like you're talking about like the teen activist, right? Even if we're in a role, I'm going to do something to lessen the suffering or help prevent further suffering of this child. It's still hard. Like that's just going to affect us. And that means you're human and you're not burnt out yet. So that's actually a good thing, is when you're like struggling with it. And kind of tossing around, like, how can things be better? What could we do for this child, for this family? And then I think sort of those self-care approaches are different for everyone. And that's okay. I think sometimes, especially early trainees, you know, they're like, I don't have a meditation practice. And that's really awesome for my co-resident. But maybe for you, it's, you know, shooting hoops or listening to music or connecting with family or whatever it is. It doesn't have to look a certain way. It's very functional. What works and gets you through the day. We've been talking about, you know, like how to make positive changes and, you know, getting feedback to clinic leadership and also like building community with the people you work with, seeing their humanities, you know, the NAs, the nurses, your colleagues, makes it feel like a less threatening, overwhelming kind of workplace. And then I think like kind of monitoring for those signs of burnout. So when you're either like not caring at all, or you're thinking like, I cannot miss a single day of work because I'm the only person ever who could help all of these patients. And you're thinking about them all night. You can't disconnect, connect with your loved ones or the activities that you do outside of work, then that might be a sign. It might feel very virtuous, like you really care and you do, and it's not sustainable. So finding ways to have that healthier balance, again, easier said than done in this sort of a career-long process, but even just kind of keeping those ideas in your mind. Like if I'm thinking about work all night long, there's something wrong here. But would love to hear from each of you, like Jason, how you've gotten through the last few weeks since the holidays, and then Scott, over your career, practices that you found really sustaining or helpful.
You know, I think you're right there. I think that what people miss is there is good stress. So it's important that we understand that the way you handle stress is like you said, is different for everybody. I always try to prioritize the things that are important to me. Really, you know, that time spending with family or, you know, the jobs that are before me. And I really don't try to get so far out. I like a little planning. I like a little planning to my day, but I'm also flexible. I don't mind calling an audible. And it kind of, you know, if somebody says, hey, you know, like I said, let's go out to dinner. Hey, sounds good to me. I wouldn't plan on going out to dinner, but you know, let's do it, whatever. You know, I mean, I'm okay with that. That doesn't really trip me up, but I do know it can trip up other people. Tax time. I mean, tax time can be just absolutely beyond, you know, stressful for people. And that's why I fill out those extensions, you know, it can't be on there forever, but it can be on there for a little bit. So
I think I've done, you know, I think there's a few things. I mean, the first thing is, even when I started medical school, I said I wasn't going to let medical training change me. And so, you know, I found something, you know, little things that I connected to. So even just like reading books for pleasure, like I'm not going to read this journal article right now. I'm going to read this random, you know, murder mystery because I like suspense thrillers and Stephen King, which probably, I don't know what that says about me. We could have
stress or bad stress.
Another session about that.
If you do that, Jason, you're going to have to pay her.
Yeah. Much to my husband's chagrin, I started this year teaching myself saxophone. So I have always wanted to learn how to play saxophone, and music has always been a stress relief for me. And so I was like, you know what? Nope, it's going to happen. And so I get on my little YouTube and I go down to our guest room. And that's where I was actually before this podcast. I was down learning a few scales on my saxophone.
So yeah, it's his earphones, right?
He's at work like right now. Yes. It's a lot of deep breathing.
Exhale.
But I think the other thing that I want to point out is as medical providers, sometimes we feel resistant to get our own medical care. And just stressing, and I'm sure Olivia, you can back me up on this. As medical providers, it is okay to seek mental health care. It is,
important to don't let it impair the work that you're doing with vulnerable kids. Yeah.
I think so many of us think that we're not supposed to be the ones who are seeking this, that we're supposed to be talking to our parents or families. It's like, no, you're taking in all of these, you know, as an empathetic human being, as an empathetic physician, why you went into this, you're taking in all of these patient stories as well. And it is important to know that, like, if you feel like you need that care, it's not a sign of like, oh, I can't do my job well. It's a sign that you are doing your job well, that you do care about each and every person who comes into your clinic or crosses your path. And I just think that is something that is really important for us to stress, is that it's okay. It's to go and find your own.
I mean, doctors are some of the most resilient people. They've had to hold it together, like succeed in high school to get into college, succeed in college to get into med school, succeed in med school to get into residency, to fellowship, to continue the career advancement. And so if you're struggling, it's not because you're not good enough or you're weak. You have demonstrated like incredible resilience over decades. It just means that things are hard. Maybe the system is hard. Maybe a particular patient is hard. Maybe other things in life are hard. Development doesn't stop in pediatrics. It continues into our adulthood. And there's developmental stressors that keep happening. So yeah, I love that message, Jason. And I think, you know, doctors are becoming more and more, and like society broadly, more open to the idea of getting mental health isn't something to be stigmatized, that really a sign of that you care and you want to be better and not let your actions negatively impact other people.
You know, there's Jason, and I know Jason remembers advocating at the federal level for the Lorna Breen, you know, healthcare law that talks about physician burnout, talks about physician suicide and trying to stymie, if you will, the mental health stigma that, you know, oh, you're a doctor, you can't have mental health problems. And it's you know, and many times if you admit that to your employer, or let's say the licensure board, yes, I have depression, they say, I'm being treated for depression. Oh, we need to, you know, limit your license or limit this or this about my career. And, you know, it makes it almost impossible to feel like you have that ability to be honest with either your employer or your licensure board and still deal with mental health issues.
Yeah, which the Lorna Breen Reauthorization Act was part of the most recent funding bill. So it has been reauthorized for another 5 years. So it's still there, people.
Yep, up through 2030. So take advantage of it, because I always believe if we don't take care of ourselves, it's very difficult to take care of other people. Mm-hmm. We, you know, everybody's, you know, maybe had a death in their family, or they need to step away, a divorce. They maybe have a lawsuit above them or on them. All of these things that are part of our, you know, life happens kind of thing, but still is stressful. And if we don't take care of ourselves, it's going to be very, very difficult to take care of other people. And you know, we all know that the workforce as physicians needs all the physicians it can get. It's very stressful just because of the workforce limitations.
So we are coming up on the hour. So I want to start to end our conversations, and I want to talk about some hopeful stuff. So it's February.
The sun's coming. The days are getting longer.
The sun is coming. We're going to have some longer days. Eventually, my temperatures will match your all's temperatures, I hope. But I'm going to start with our special guest. Is there anything that you are looking forward to for the spring? Just something that brings you joy right now.
I think, so we're blessed with so much sun in New Mexico, and we have some camping trips planned in the next few months. Even, you'll be shocked, Jason, from where you are, but even in 2 weeks, we're going to start to get camping going. So kind of took a break over winter, but it'll be really nice to be out in the mountains and in the forest and spending time outside. So really looking forward to that.
Very nice.
All right. Now I'm going to call an audible. Like I told you earlier, I don't mind calling audibles. So I'm going to bring this back around because I think it's really, really important. You are at the University of New Mexico, and you are an associate professor, correct? Assistant.
Assistant professor.
Assistant professor.
It took me a long time to figure out.
But you are a part of the Child Fellowship in Psychiatry, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Real quick, if you will, I've been kind of waiting to the end to ask this question. Tell us your path to child psychiatry, because we may have people out there now that are going, hey, you know, I like kids, I like psychiatry, I want to put these two together. Tell us real quickly, if you will, your pathway to child psychiatry. How did you go about it? Did you go, you know, which way? Psychiatry, then child, or pediatrics, and then psychiatry, or what? Tell us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there can be that identity confusion. I actually, one of my fellows right now is a practicing pediatrician for many years and is now going back to do her child and adult psychiatry residency. So it can happen. You mentioned, Scott, that I had a genetic risk to be a child psychiatrist. I'm actually a third generation psychiatrist. My dad's brothers are child psychiatrists too. And I like Jason, majored in theater and was not going to have anything to do with medical field.
I've tried to imagine like holiday dinner tables. Does everyone just analyze everything? Is everyone like sex?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'd go to Wichita 4 hours away and way back. You're just discussing everyone's dynamics.
Your green beans aren't touching your corn, I notice.
Yeah. We'd be one of those. So yeah, I majored in theater and really like how it could, in that youthful way, right, contribute to like positive social change and get people to understand themselves and the world in a different way. But wanted to have like a more direct impact and direct feedback. So started looking at medicine, and I was between PEDS and hence shadowing you, Scott, and psychiatry. And I felt really grateful that child psychiatry existed. It felt like I really loved, for some people, I think that's a hard ask to give up the rest of medicine, that they love the full body, the physiology. They like to stay sort of on top of it all. And to be a pediatrician, again, you're not like first line access. So it's really, I think, about increasing access to care and like taking care of the community in a really broad way. I was okay leaving the rest of the body largely behind, focus on the brain and the subjective experience of kids and families and adults. And so I think, you know, for those who are like, my favorite part of the patient encounter is getting to talk to the patient, not checking the labs and maybe sort of like other aspects, but getting to hear someone's story and supporting them, then maybe psychiatry is for you. And if you like that, but you also want to make sure you're caring for the whole person in a really meaningful way, then that I would think maybe more about PEDS. But I think both are, as mentioned before, there is such a need for good people in these fields. It's I think, some of the best jobs in the world. We're so lucky to get to care for kids and families and make a meaningful difference. So I think both are good choices. And folks can reach out to me if they have any questions about sort of the child psych pathway.
Very good. Thank you. I just, like I said, I didn't want to get away without, like I said, we need more child psychiatrists than you can imagine. It's such a helpful field for general pediatricians, but there's just not. Somebody once told me, he said, I think only child psychiatrists can diagnose ADHD. And I went, holy cow, if we gave all the ADHD kids to just psychiatry, they wouldn't be able to do anything else.
Yes, pediatricians can do so much.
Let's give them the most difficult ADHD, not the bread and butter ADHD. But
that's like, give us your bipolar disorder.
That's right. It's like giving every ear infection to the ENT. It's like,
for sure. Wouldn't
even go down that route. But going back to Jason's question, and that is what I'm looking forward to spring. I tell you, spending more time with the family. We just celebrated this last weekend the 6-year-old's birthday, and we've got more birthdays coming up. And just like I said, spending more time with family, I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot, and it's fun. So
very nice. Well, I guess, you know, my first immediate is installing that television that just got delivered to my house. Yeah. So after this one, the next podcast that will come out will be the last week of March. And at that point, it will be the day before the ACOP conference for the spring and during DO Day on the Hill. So, you know, I think looking at your bio, Olivia, I think you enjoy to advocate for children. You work with foster kids. And so I'm very excited to be back on Capitol Hill as whatever function it will be in at that point. But I'm also more excited for the fact that we're going to be getting all of our ACOP family together in my current hometown, I guess, in Columbus, because the ACOP conference is in Columbus this year. So hopefully, if you are not registered yet, come and hang out with us. I'll show you around the Buckeye City. But I will say, one of the things, I feel like mine is so lame because you're talking about going camping and you're talking about spending more time with family. I'm like, I'm going to do more work.
But I'm too. Advocacy piece can also be energizing and be part of that self-care.
Yes, I will say part of my self-care is going to advocate. When I get to go and do that role as a physician advocate is really something that really regenerates me. So as lame and as corny as it sounds, that's what I'm looking forward to. Oh, I guess my hospital's sending me to Belgium. So I'm going to go hang out just outside of Brussels for the Congenital Diaphragmatic Hernia conference.
Me.
I love that advocating for kids in Columbus was number one. And then
and go to Belgium. The thing I'm not looking forward to is because the hospital said to me I have to fly economy to Belgium. So.
For yourself, Marta.
There you go. See?
But I think God, Scott.
I was gonna say, send in what it costs for a coach ticket and upgrade.
I'm working on that. So we'll see what happens. But so it looks like we all all three of us have some things we're looking forward to. Olivia, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I think this is a very important topic that we don't talk about enough, frankly, just like, you know, mental health as an issue with our patients and also mental health with ourselves, and not a topic that's talked about a lot for our trainees either. We don't really, we talk about a whole lot of systems and not this one.
Residency is so hard. What an intense time. Thank you so much for having me and for all the work you all do for pediatricians broadly, kids and families, trainees. Really appreciate you highlighting these issues and keeping the conversation going. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Great to have you. Thank you very much. You know, it's a lot of good tips and a lot of good information. It'll suit you well to always take care of yourself.
Yes. And thank you to listeners. Happy 2026. We will hopefully have some really great content out for you in the coming months. We'll find out when the March one is going to be recorded, because between DOD and ACOP and everything else, I'll make sure that Scott and I can find a time to get together. But we are very thankful for those of you who continue to listen. Scott, just so you know, I looked up, we have over 1,300, so over 1,300 downloads. So someone's listening to us.
Wow. That's good.
Like Scott said at the beginning, hope you spend a lot of time celebrating every small success. And we will see you all in March. Have a great day, everyone. The ACOP PEDScast podcast series is the official podcast of the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians. Your hosts are Jason Jackson Dio and Scott Cyrus Dio. Edited by Jason Jackson. Original music by James Cyrus of Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any requests for topics or you'd like to be a guest on the PEDScast podcast series, please email us at PEDScast, PEDScast@acopeds.org.